I don't think it's fair or right that someone would wait 25 to 35 or more years of their life to draw a tag for one of these trophy units like Emily and have to compete with spike hunters.
How many spike hunters are those 58 branch bull hunters going up against?
Okay, so the bull elk season for this year, or this could have been last year's, but it runs November 1st through November 19th. And in that time frame, there are two spike hunts that are spike only hunts. The first is November 1st through the 5th. There's a little gap, and then it's the 11th through the 19th. And between those dates, there are almost 1,000 spike hunters to the 58 branch bull hunters. So 58 people have waited a quarter of their life or more to draw this tag, and they are shoulder to shoulder with 1,000 spike hunters. And that's insane.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. Four years ago, I bought a new truck for the first time ever, and I was so excited. It was incredible. It smelled good. It felt good. I wasn't constantly afraid of breaking down, you know? It was awesome. But after I drove it for a couple weeks, I do the same thing that I always do, and the backseat started to fill up with stuff. You know, I'm guiding elk hunters and deer hunters, and I'm duck hunting, and I'm fly fishing, and all that gear just accumulates. And pretty soon, I wasn't able to take people with me anymore, and I was embarrassed. You know, people would ask for a ride, and like, nah, sorry, man, I've got too much stuff with me. But I couldn't put it in the bed because then it gets damaged by weather. So I go to the internet, and I'm looking for options, and I ended up buying a deck-to-drawer system. Now, this was a big purchase for me, but it's something that I felt like I needed, and it looked like it was going to be a good product, and it really was. Dect came out with a new drawer system this year, and they've made some meaningful improvements over the previous one. You have almost no wasted space in your truck bed now, so you can access the sides of the drawers, and then the drawers roll a full 18 inches farther out, so you can actually access the back of the drawer, even if you don't have a lot of arm reach. There's some really strong tie-down points on top. They have a 400-pound load rating, so if you're going to haul something like a motorcycle or big coolers or whatever, you can really strap your gear down and make it secure. You can lock these drawer systems, so you can lock the drawers, or if your tailgate locks, then nobody can access the drawers anyways. So I actually feel like my stuff is more secure inside this drawer system than in the cab of my truck. That's a big deal to me. The complete deck system is made in America by Americans, and you know that that's something that I love and appreciate. They've got one that will fit in any truck or van that's been made in America in the last 20 years plus. You can go to decked.com/sixranch and get free shipping. But just being honest with you, they get free shipping to everybody. I also, while you're there, want you to check out their deco line. So they've got a bunch of different boxes and storage containers that either fit on top of or inside of the drawer system. And those are built really robust. I saw the prototypes at an event this summer. I'm impressed. I'm excited to get my hands on them. I haven't yet. But the prototypes were super badass. And the ones that are in production model, they're available now over at decked.com. So even if you just need a place for some tools, or you need a new bow case, or you know, something along those lines, go check that out. And if you're driving around right now and your backseat is just full of gear and you can't haul people around, maybe you should consider looking at the full deck drawer system, because it's a good piece of gear. It was a good purchase for me, and I hope it helps you. Okay. Keep going.
Okay, so long story short, I notoriously cut myself with whatever I'm skinning with, which is almost always my Havilon. And it's usually when my hands get cold, just because I can't feel what I'm doing. or I'm just tired and not paying attention. So I've got, as you can see, plenty of scars all over the place from that. And I was just one day, I'm like, I really want to get a finger tattoo. And I'm like, wouldn't it be funny if I got Avalon? Because that's what I use every day. And so I got it. And now it's a very friendly reminder that I need to not cut myself. And weirdly enough, I haven't been.
Oh, that's good.
So, yeah, it's great. It's super convenient. But that's like the one thing I do every morning. I have like the same ritual when I'm out guiding is like, I get up, go in. If the coffee isn't started, I start it. And then I throw my Havilon in my pocket with a couple blades and then we get going.
I stabbed myself pretty good with a Havilon one time. I've cut myself with them a couple times, but I was working on an elk for a gal named Barb, and it was her first elk, and she's a little bit freaked out about the whole thing. Like, mm-hmm. She didn't really want to go elk hunting. She kind of did, you know, how that whole thing is. But we went, she made a beautiful shot, like 300 yards, 300 Win Mag. This cow went 10 yards and went down. Just wonderful. Everything's good.
Love when they just go down.
Yeah. Shot in the top of the heart. Everything was just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
We get over there and it wasn't a spot where we could get the elk out whole. So I was cutting it up and cold, in a hurry, not paying attention. And I slipped and I stabbed myself like.
Oh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Like.
Oh, I've got one of those too. Here.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. So this was like kind of in the femoral artery region. And I just pulled the knife out really quick. And I was like, you know, I'm not going to worry too much about that.
Until it starts gushing a minute later.
Well, that's the deal. And I keep cutting on this elk. And then I look down and my knee is just completely soaked. And there's blood like coming out. And I'm like, is that elk blood or is that James blood? And I was like, all right, Barb, time to not look. I got to pull my pants down. And I hadn't cut the artery. Otherwise, I'd be dead. But yeah, those things are dangerous. I don't really love them. I'm not a throwaway blade guy anymore.
Yeah.
I kind of like the real knives.
Most of the guides out there, they use Outdoor Edge. And I actually carry one of those as well. So I usually have my two knives. I use my Havilon for everything except the Outdoor Edge. I use the gut hook. And I was actually given that by one of my guides as a gift my first year out there. He bought it for me for my birthday.
That like ripper knife one that's fixed blade? That is a good knife.
Yeah, it's great. And so he gave me that as a gift and I love him to death. And so I just always have it with me. I use that for that one purpose and then I put it back in my pocket and I use my Havilon for everything else. But I don't have very big hands. And so a lot of these like hunting knives are meant for like, this isn't like me being like sexist or misogynistic or complaining about things or whatever, but it's just, it fits better. The Havilon just fits a lot better in my hand. And so I can like get in there and especially for caping, it's great. Cause I can just get like right in the like eye sockets and all of the stuff and having not an issue. But yeah, ever since I got that, I have done that a lot less and I've had to get it touched up twice cause it, you know, like rubs. But no, that was a really snap decision that I made once.
Kevin Rogers, who is, you know, one of the first people to ever be on this podcast and a veterinarian and an incredible guy. He's also a pretty incredible knife maker. He made me a scalpel this year. And as a vet, he's got actual like mileage with a scalpel probably. Mm-hmm. And whenever I'm caping, especially working around tear ducts and things like that, I want to be just as precise as possible. The other time that I really want to be precise is working around the claws on a bear.
Oh, yeah.
On a bear or a lion. Like, that's so easy to punch through the skin and get wrong. And a scalpel is the right thing, except that scalpel blades wear out really quickly, and you can't pry with them at all. So he made me this fixed blade forged scalpel that I absolutely love. So now that's just part of my kit, and I did... Gosh.
So is it like a Damascus where it's like the kind of layered look?
So it's not actually, this one's not Damascus. It's monogamous steel. I think that's the right word. It's a single piece of steel.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And but it's got a full hilt, and he did forge it and shape it and all that stuff, and has some G10 scales on it. It's a super cool thing, and you can kind of do that pencil grip with it that mm-hmm. works so well when you're doing precision stuff. I love that. But before we get down the rabbit hole of knives and cutting up animals too much further,
okay.
Who are you?
Well, my name is Hannah, and I manage a hunting operation for a large private landowner here in northeastern Oregon. And I guess I'm a conservationist at heart. I'm a board member of the local Oregon Hunters Association chapter, and I'm really proud of that. I think it does a lot of good. This is pretty much my life at this point. This, which is not what I went to school for, but that's all right.
What did you go to school for?
I actually got my bachelor's in public health and mm-hmm. was working on my master's in public health and healthcare management. And then I took this job and kind of just put a pin in that. May go back to it at some point, may not, but I very much enjoy what I do now. So
this is better.
This is a lot cooler.
This is better.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I feel like you can do more for people's mental health by taking them hunting than you can by just about anything else.
Seen a lot of tears. And that's like the best part about the whole thing is being able to help someone achieve their goal. That's really the reason I do it and continue to do it is that. But I've learned a lot of life lessons out here. And it's really just a great place to be, I think. I really can't complain about anything other than just sometimes there's really long hours and sometimes there's people that you don't necessarily want to be hunting with, but
that's the reality of guiding.
Yeah, that's guiding and that's life. Like you would have, you know, clients that you don't like, you have customers you don't like. It just doesn't matter what you do in your line of work, like you can't like everybody. So for the most part, our client base is really awesome. They're great people.
The way elk season is structured here in Oregon, and with the cow seasons and the damage seasons that are on top of all that now, we hunt elk for most of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So what does your year of elk look like?
As far as like the months?
Yeah.
August through March.
Yep.
But I slow down now. So the bulk of our hunts are August through mid-December. And then I kind of taper off. And that's when I have all my guides out scheduled as well. But this time forward to the end of that season, it's just me guiding. Occasionally, I'll have a few other people out. And so I'll have one of my other guides come up for a weekend or whatever to help. But from now on, it's just for damage. I don't want to run it like the full tilt operation just because, you know, it's a lot of the restrictions have it to where we have to be in a certain area to hunt these elk this time of the year. And when it's nice out like it is right now, we don't have snow. I'm not going to waste people's time or money with having them come here and us not see anything. So, it's slowing down a little bit, but still have a couple months left, so things can change really quick.
Hopefully with the mildness of this fall and winter so far and all the green grass that we have, the elk damage won't be as bad this year. That would be really nice.
That would be really nice, yeah. And if, you know, the thing is we try to keep them down on the public ground as much as possible. We have a program in place with OSP, ODF&W, whatnot, that, you know, we kind of drive them back towards public ground. We try to keep them down there as much as possible. And that's something we do all year. It's not just something we're doing right now to prevent damage. And I think some people may have the wrong idea of what we're doing with that. I think they think we're trying to harass wildlife when in reality, it wasn't until about, I want to say 15, 20 years ago when the elk damage really started becoming a problem where I'm at. Because they used to just go down to the Bridge Creek Wildlife Area, but now they come north. I'm not entirely sure as to why that is, but they do. And it's very frustrating for the landowners in that area because they're used to having high deer numbers and some elk around, but not a ton. And now there's low deer numbers, which, I mean, that's is statewide, but there are low deer numbers and elk everywhere. And they're calving down here and they're staying down here. They're not going back. And so it's just a constant battle.
Yeah. Well, part of that, which, you know, needs to be said, is that 15 to 20 years ago when this started happening was the exact same time that the mountain lion population really started to increase.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you have elk and deer in the same area, elk are going to win, it seems like. And now that we have wolves in the mix as well, elk are going to favor the ground and the herd dynamics that are more survivable for them. Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I actually was just talking with a hunter who wants to come out for an archery buck hunt this year, and we were talking about that exact same thing with, you know, the lack of hound hunting around, and, you know, just even bringing that up at all, people are, it's such a controversial topic, but I don't think it needs to be because there's just such a very obvious downward trend since 95. With the mule deer population. And even on private land, it's shocking. Like, I've cut the deer tags back like in half multiple times just because there's no deer to be taken. But we also want to try to grow a stable population of mature bucks that are, we call them feeder bucks for the next year.
Yeah.
Or cedars, I guess. But even on private land, there's a significant lack of deer, and there's still a ton of deer tags, and there's far more mountain lions than there ever has been historically. So, you know, one easy way to combat that, or easier way, is with hounds, but you can't do that.
Well, you can on private, because lions are part of that Oregon wildlife damage statute.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, the reality of running lions is that you need dogs that are pretty skilled at it and pretty practiced. And who has that, you know? Like, that the houndsmen are gone. And there's a few bobcat guys around, but it's nothing like it was in the 80s and early 90s when every pickup had a dog box in the back of it and there's really good hounds. And, you know, if you had a problem lion, that thing was going to get caught today. We lost that infrastructure, that critical infrastructure, and we could get it back, but it's too much to ask for people just to like keep dogs trained all year long, just so that they can show up for free to help you out whenever you have a problem lion. And then, you know, that's for like health and human safety stuff. But if you start to talk about the population dynamics, and what's happening with mule deer, that's an entirely different conversation. One thing that I think people don't realize about hound hunting that I was thinking about yesterday, actually, because I got a new barn cat yesterday, little barn kitten, cutest little thing. And, of course, one of the first things I do is flip it around and pick up its tail to see whether it's a male or a female that we caught in our live trap, you know? And it brought me back to when I was running lions in college in Montana. They separate their quotas for male and female by unit. So there's some units where you can't kill any female lions. In Oregon, the way we hunt now, it's impossible to know whether you're hunting a male or a female lion.
Right, unless you actually physically see the kittens with it, which isn't that common.
Right. And then that's not an animal that you're hunting anyways, right? So if it's just a single animal on the hillside, you really can't tell. You can't tell for sure. But if they're up in a tree because you treat them with dogs, now you can get in there and you can actually see if it's a male or a female. The advantage to that for people that are, you know, pro lion and want a good lion population, if you restrict units to male only, and you have houndsmen go in there and they can only kill male lions, that's actually going to increase the lion population in the area, because that male lion is going to be out there killing kittens every time it finds them to try and force the female lions into heat. So even the people that oppose hound hunting because they want to help lions don't understand that they're probably hurting the lion population by doing so.
Right.
It would help so much if we could get dogs back, but Unfortunately, because that was a ballot measure, the only thing that can really undo it is another ballot measure.
Which is a very big ask.
Yeah.
But this is the first year. I mean, we've seen lion kills out on the ranch and things along those lines. But this is the first year where a lion has actually charged our clients. And was not great.
Yeah.
They were here turkey hunting. It was a youth turkey hunt. The kid was from,
oh no,
I want to say Oklahoma. It was a filmed thing. And I actually had this weird feeling when they showed up, and I never tell my turkey hunters to do this, but I was like, you know what? You guys should just buy a lion tag. It's only 15, 16 bucks, even for non-residents. Like, yep, just get it. There's been a cat in this area that we've been trying to take care of for a while, but he's really smart. He's really elusive. But I think because there's been so many turkeys there, you should probably have one. And they were like, haha, okay. So they bought one. I had dropped them off because it was one of those semi-guided turkey hunt deals. I dropped them off in the spot, and I was walking out, and it was so quiet. Like, no elk noises, no birds, nothing. And I'm like, this is bizarre. And about 20 minutes later, so I had just gotten in the side-by-side, drove up to another spot, and I was looking for more birds over there, and my phone just starts blowing up. Like phone call, texts. Like, the thing was basically short-circuiting. And I finally got a message that came through, and I clicked on it, and it was the hunter, and he's like, there's a lion, and it just, like, tried to attack us. And I was like, oh, okay. So, like, do you want me to come pick you up? Is everyone okay? And they're like, we're good. We're going to try to get this one bird to come in. But then please come pick us up. And I'm like, okay. And they had just started calling, and the cat just came out, like, right behind this tree and ran right at him. And when they all moved, because it must not have known that there were four of them there, it darted off into the brush behind them, and they tried to get a shot off at it. They tried to see it again, and they didn't. But they were like, oh, it full on charged us, like, came 30 yards in like a second and a half.
Yeah.
Like, ooh.
Yeah.
Whoops. Sorry about that.
Shotgun's a good
thing.
Don't
have those in Oklahoma, I guess.
Yeah. Shotgun's a good thing to have for that. I had one show up behind me when I was calling a bull in for a guy 2 years ago. And, you know, but not everybody else does, that I operate in a similar area to you. Anyways, it was dark. I was trying to figure out how big this bull was, and I was trying to keep him close until it was shooting light. I was holding a decoy. I never set decoys up because we're moving too often and it's just chaos. So I'm just holding on to it. And I heard something behind me, and I turned around, and there was a lion that was like 20 yards away. Now, as far as I know, this bull is like the next world record elk. You know, I can't just go shooting this freaking cat and scare off my client's elk. And it wasn't an emergency yet. So I'm like trying
to, 20
yards,
not an emergency. Okay.
I'm like trying to, like, quietly, like, shoo this lion away, and, you know, without scaring elk, and just waiting for it to get a little bit darker. And it came towards me a little bit more, and I dropped the decoy and drew my pistol, and then it turned around and it stopped and looked back and finally left. And we ended up calling in the bull, and he wasn't that big. So I should have just shot the freaking lion and been done with it. But yeah, it's definitely a thing. It seems to be increasingly a thing with the turkey hunters in the spring. I don't know what's going on with lions in the spring that makes them, you know,
they love turkeys.
Come in that hard, but they do.
Yeah. And I mean, they're so vocal that time of the year. I think that has a lot to do with it. They just,
the turkeys are.
Yeah. Not the cats. The turkeys are definitely vocal and probably just easier targets. I don't know. I mean, anytime I see turkeys, I usually hear them, but, you know, the gobbles and everything, that's so loud.
Yeah. And so our Rios are not the smartest turkey out there. Yeah.
No, they're not very smart. I've gotten away with so much, like, public and private ground where I'm like, okay, well.
Yeah.
But I've also had, like, one or two really, like, actually tough turkey hunts before where I'm, like, belly crawling. I've got my shotgun on my back, and, like, I end up crawling, like, 500-600 yards total trying to get close to this bird, and, like, scratched up. There's burrs everywhere. I have, like, a cut on my neck for some reason, just, like, ridiculous stuff. I'm like, I'm doing this for a bird?
That's
what
a
am
lot
I
of work.
Doing? I'm
That's
like, what's
a lot
going
of work
on
for
right
a yard
now?
Bird.
I know. I'm like, this is stupid. But you know, you kind of get in the moment and you kind of forget all about it, especially if it's a nice one. But I'm not going to do that again for a turkey. Never.
Yeah.
I was like 16, 17. And I'm like, I have to get this. It's a pride thing. Like at this point, like it's like me versus bird, but
yeah,
not all of them are really dumb.
Those are good lessons to learn. I ended up trying to like sneak up on a turkey, and I took my boots off one time. This is outside of Elgin.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I must have watched some freaking video that told me that that was a good idea. But I ended up miles and miles away in my socks, and then, you know, spending like hours of my life trying to find my boots. And it's like, this is dumb. I've done a lot of dumb things for turkeys. I'm not proud of any of them. But yeah, you end up finding yourself in that situation. Speaking of, how did you end up in this position? Because I don't think that there's many, models that bear hunt. Like, you're a really unique human. And I think that because of, you know, your qualification, your knowledge about wildlife, your ability to manage the business side of it, which is incredibly rare, as well as the actual hunting operation side of it. That's amazing. And then you've got modeling on the side of all that. Like, how did this happen?
Well, first off, thank you. I appreciate that. That's very kind. The modeling thing, I've kind of done off and on for a while, and then I signed with an agency more recently, and I've just been doing stuff with them through that. But, you know, I have always had an interest in hunting. My family started me really young, which is kind of the story you are used to hearing. And I didn't get really into it until college. Like, I did go deer hunting and elk hunting with the family. My dad told us never shoot a bear because he didn't want to deal with cleaning a bear. But my brother and I were always like, let's go bear hunting. We want to do it so bad. And so I didn't have any background with predator hunting, with the exception of some like coyote stuff. Going into college, unfortunately, I made some really awesome friends when I was there after I had transferred away from University of Portland to Eastern. And we would just skip class. We would read forums, watch YouTube videos, like all kinds of stuff, trying to figure out like, what can we do to be better lion hunters, bear hunters, things along those lines. And we kind of started to piece together. We got pretty efficient at calling cats for a while, like in the Starkey unit specifically. I mean, Ladd Canyon's like covered in them. And what we needed to do to find bears. And so, I mean, that's that. And I got more passionate about it, and it really piqued my interest, from a conservation aspect as well, because predator hunting is, it's becoming more mainstream, but it just wasn't that big of a thing for a long time, it seemed.
It was like shed hunting.
Yeah. Like it was a niche thing. Like some people would do it in the hunting community, but it wasn't just like a widespread thing. And now it's actually great that more people are wanting to go like spring bear hunting. Cause even if they're not necessarily successful, they're still out there. And most people, I think, are going to shoot the first one they see, which might not be a huge one. But that's still one more bear that's not, you know, out eating calves and things along those lines.
Sure. And if you're in Eastern Oregon, like, don't try and shop bears.
No. Like, that drives me nuts. Like, it drives me crazy when people do that.
Yeah. Like, none of them are big. The mm-hmm. biggest one we have here isn't big.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like hunting blacktail on Kodiak Island. It's like, just shoot one. Like, okay, if you hunt like all the entire season, every day as hard as you can, you might shoot a little tiny 4-point instead of a little tiny 3-point. Just shoot one and like move on with
it's
your life.
It's the experience. It's not the trophy. So. Yeah. Yeah, that's a thing.
And a bigger bear is just bigger problems. Like just have a good time. Shoot the bear. Make mm-hmm. a good shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go over there and skin it. Get all greasy. Covered in ticks.
Yeah, so gross. Love it. so nasty.
No ticks on that bear I killed in Carolina last week.
No ticks on the bear. That was a pretty bear.
Thanks.
No ticks on the bear that I got in Montana. There was ticks on the bear in Idaho, and there were no ticks on the Washington bear.
Idaho always has ticks.
Yeah, every time. And I've gone up there and literally sat down to glass and looked down, and I see him like crawling up my pants, and I'm like, oh God, oh my God. Cause like I can handle guts, blood, all kinds of things, all kinds of smells. But the one, well, there's two things, but the one big thing that really freaks me out is ticks. And it's because I have a family member that got Lyme disease. And so I just, I'm like, I don't want anything to do with that.
You know what scares me even more is that Lone Star tick. Do you know about that one?
Don't do this to me.
I'm going
to
do it. You ready?
No. Okay, go ahead.
The Lone Star tick can carry a disease that if it bites you, you are no longer able to eat red meat.
I think I've heard about this. Yeah, but
it is a real thing. They're in Texas. They're in Oklahoma. They're in a bunch of places. And the more you get bit, the worse it is.
And so it can bite you multiple times or multiple ticks?
Multiple ticks.
Okay. I was like, James.
It's not the one tick that's just like,
I know. I'm like, wait, hold on.
No,
I'm about to have a panic attack. I'm sweating.
If you're in the area and you're getting attacked by this demon, like Bill Gates tick on the regular. So it can get better after a few years. And you can start eating red meat again. But some people, it's a lifelong thing.
Oh, no. Oh, I don't even know what I would do. It would be an existential crisis, to say the least. I know it would be for you, too. Like, what are you... You got to, like, change everything.
Find a tall bridge and aim for something hard.
Yeah, like, I'm going to sex start a pistol today.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No.
Like, no.
What are you going to do? Not. Live on chicken?
Like, or no. Wild turkey. Mm-mm. You can live on wild turkey and
pass.
Fish.
Pass.
Hard no.
It'd be so sad.
Oh, that would be the worst. So, yeah, ticks are bad.
I got roasted. I mean, massacred by mosquitoes on that bear hunt in Carolina, though.
Is it just warm over there right now?
It was 70 degrees.
Really?
It's 70 degrees when it's dark outside.
Oh, my gosh. No, they don't hibernate, do they? They just take little nappies?
Not even little nappies. So a sow will hibernate if she needs to have cubs. If she does need to have cubs, she won't hibernate. Or if she's got yearlings with her. But... it's crazy. And then, you know, the world record was just broken yesterday in North Carolina for...
Is that officially? Because I saw something about that, but I wasn't sure.
So, that's the thing. It's world record weight for a bow, 774 pounds.
Oh, okay.
And it was at Stansel's certified scale. I saw it, I believe it, 774 pounds, which is a long way short of the world record black bear with a rifle, which was in that 900 pound range, also killed in the same area. But yeah, new archery world record for weight. We'll have to have a drying period before they can measure the skull
and
all that. But the skulls aren't as big on those bears as they are on some. There's some theories that the genetics of the bears in that area are shared with the short face bear or the cave bear that went extinct at the end of the Pleistocene, which is part of what allows them to get, you know, bigger than all
right,
of the rest of the
physically
bears.
They're giant. They're significantly larger than the bears over here.
Yeah. And they can just put weight on like crazy.
Yeah. I've looked into some bear hunting like over in Pennsylvania and whatnot. And I've had people ask like, why would you do that? And I'm like, well, if you look at like the top standing records for bears across like Boone and Crockett, Pope and Young, whatever, the majority of them are East Coast bears, like North Carolina,
Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Wisconsin, and Northern California. There's like these little isolated pockets of big bears, and it doesn't seem to have as much to do with like availability of food or even terrain type or vegetation as just like some genetic pockets, because there's plenty of bears that can eat as much as they want and don't get to be 774 pounds. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah. Northern California is a place that I've been looking into because I've got quite a few clients that are from like the Bay Area and like Northern California. And that's something a lot of them do is bear hunt, which kind of shocked me, honestly, because they come up here and they go elk hunting. And some of them are obviously very experienced, but others don't have the experience but are still successful at killing bears down there. And one, their bear population is like out of control, but they're getting big bears.
Really
like
big
bears. The biggest one I've gotten here, or just in general, was here in Oregon, and it was aged at 17.
That's an old bear.
It was very old. He had like next to no teeth in his mouth. It was gross. But he was like 330, like, you know, that was.
Did you weigh him?
Or yeah, we got him hung up.
Wow.
But yeah, loading him in the back of the side by side, we had to drag him out of a creek bottom. It was nasty. But yeah, that was the biggest that I've gotten so far. But I'd like to beat that.
I was supposed to go hunt with Luke Spence in Northern California this year. He's Northern Cali Outdoors _247. That guy kills some monster bears. Oh, look at that.
Yeah.
See, that's deceptive because people don't know that you're
giant,
freakishly tall.
Yeah, that I'm a very large human. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't call you that, but you're tall for sure.
Yeah. And yeah. I was kind of standing in front of it a little bit too in that picture, so it wasn't like... I wasn't doing the guide thing where you're like, hey, hold this horn with this arm extended and then sit over here,
dude,
please.
I'm not cool with even calling that a guide thing. That is a client thing. That is some
it is definitely a client
baloney.
Thing.
I hate it, man.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Sometimes I'll see pictures before I post them to the Hunt Oregon Instagram, and I'm like, I don't really want to do this because that is deceiving. That is a deceiving picture,
yeah,
and it drives me nuts.
That's 140-inch mule deer, but we're going to...
Yeah.
We're going to use the old 1.5 lens and make him look like he's 165.
I have a little question for you.
Okay.
What do you feel about guides taking pictures with their clients' animals?
Like solo?
Yeah.
I'm not cool with it, with one exception. If you have a client who just straight up doesn't want to be in photos for whatever reason, That's the exception. And then you need to be real obvious that that is not an animal that you pulled the trigger on. But yeah, there's some guides out there that will take like straight up grip and grins with every single one of their clients' animals.
It is the cringiest thing I think I've ever, like, since being in this industry. It makes me just like, ooh, I will know. If you can go through any one of our posts, and at the very most, there will be like the guide that helped that client in the picture with the client. But none of my guides and myself included take pictures with our clients' animals because I think it is so cringy. It doesn't matter how big it is.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, granted, you know, you could have done all of the scouting for it and all of these things, put in all this effort. You didn't pull the trigger at the end of the day. Someone paid probably a pretty good amount of money to shoot that, and it's not your glory.
Well, I don't even know about the glory aspect of it. Like, I don't think it's all that glorious in the first place, but...
No, but, you know, that's what it's for.
I think that there's a way to take a picture that tells a story that's respectful to the situation, and, like, I've definitely got pictures posted with client stuff. But it's not in the same way, like, as if that were my accomplishment. You know?
You're not, like, posing with it.
No. Usually it's like I'm trying to get his head sorted out and another guide, like, snapped a picture. And I'm like, oh, that looks kind
of
cool.
Yeah. It's more of, like, an editorial shot in a way where it's, like, telling a story about the animal, which I've posted those as well. I think they're super great. Like, one of my bull hunters that I took out this year, like, there's pictures of her bull on my Instagram and Facebook, but it's never like there was never any, you know, thing making it look like I killed that. It was this is something we did together and it was great and we had a great time. And here's us getting it into the back of the side by side, just the two of us. And it was a whole deal. But
I remember that. That was a great post.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. It wasn't, you know, it was like opening morning and I wanted her to be picky because I wanted her to get a really nice bull. And there were a few sixes that I'd been seeing around where I was totally, you know, I know she would be totally happy with it. They were like 280 to 310-ish. And we were just getting into this spot and I look up on the hill and there was like four branch bulls and a handful of cows. And I'm like, cool, let's make a move. I can see a six in that group that, you know, would be good, especially with it just being day one. And she ended up getting that other one, but she made a perfect shot and I ended up dragging the thing off the hill, and that made the knees hurt a little bit, and that's okay, but it's all part of the fun. And she's amazing. I love her and her husband dearly. They come every year, but no, that was a good time. Yeah. Just another one of those, like, will forever stay in the memory bank situations.
Once again, I'm interrupting this show to bring you a few minutes of wildlife biology. Today, we're going to talk about chronic wasting disease. Hunting in the western United States has become more and more complex each year, with each state having its own game management system, series of political structures, and a massive influx of hunters. It seems that there are any number of circumstances stacked against the average person looking to fill a tag. While these problems aren't going away, it's critical to remember that there are also factors that are stacking up against common wildlife species that pose very real effects to game populations. One of the hottest topics in the wildlife realm, particularly those with an affinity for the large four-legged critters like deer and elk, you have probably heard of the term CWD, or chronic wasting disease. CWD even gets its 5 minutes of fame in national and mainstream news and is wildly named the zombie deer disease by many news outlets. While those of us who spend time around deer and elk know that this is far from the truth, it still strikes fear in game managers, hunters, conservationists. CWD was first identified at a captive mule deer facility used for research in the state of Colorado in the late 1960s, where it was given its name and found in the brain of symptomatic animals. This disease was found to be a transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. I don't know if I said that right. Following necropsy, and was shortly after recognized in a captive research population in Wyoming. Transmissible spongiform encephalopathy are a rare type of disease caused by prions. Prions are advanced and probably deserve an entire series dedicated just explaining what they are. So we'll avoid the metaphorical weeds wrapped around the axle and leave it at their really weird misfolded proteins. While TSCs are quite rare, there are certain TSCs that you may be more familiar with because they affect humans. These include mad cow disease and the infamous Kuru disease, which is transmitted through cannibalism. Yuck. While CWD probably seems less scary to humans, it is often presented as a wide range of clinical signs. It can include irregular movement and posture, circling to one side, grinding of the teeth, loss of awareness for surroundings, massive weight loss, abnormal thirst, drooling, and excessive urination. The last three clinical signs, abnormal thirst, drooling, and excessive urination, are commonly thought to be the additional prions shedding into the environment and further propagating the disease, like a cough or sneeze puts bacteria and viruses into the air. CWD is fatal and untreatable. Additionally, prions are incredibly resilient, and it's unclear how long they can last in an environment and remain transmissible. Currently, CWD is present in 30 states and 2 Canadian provinces, with each having varying infection rates. In Colorado, some areas of the state have greater than 40% infection rates. Some areas of Montana have over 70% infection rates. However, in Colorado, from 2015 to 2017, less than 15% of white-tailed deer were infected statewide. Midwest states have seen a rapid uptick in cases, as well as researchers have recommended removal of mineral licks and supplemental feed sites, and any activity that can congregate deer into one area to reduce transmission. Other states, like Washington, have taken a more proactive approach and are opportunistically sampling animals to look for CWD. Oregon's doing the same thing. We've had it show up right next door in Idaho, but so far it has not been detected in Oregon or Washington. The Chronic Wasting Disease Alliance states that hunters, quote, do not shoot, handle, or consume any animal that is acting abnormally or appears to be sick. Contact your state game and fish department if you see or harvest an animal that appears sick. Wear latex or rubber gloves when field dressing your deer or elk. Bone out the meat from your animal. Don't saw through the bone and avoid cutting through the brain or spinal column. Minimize the handling of brain and spinal tissues. Wash hands and instruments thoroughly after field dressing is completed. Instruments, cutting boards, and other items used for processing should be soaked for 5 minutes in a 40% solution of household bleach to inactivate prions. And there's some evidence to suggest that bleach doesn't even kill these things, but better to try anyways. Avoid consuming brain, spinal cord, eyes, spleen, tonsils, lymph nodes of harvested animals. Avoid consuming the meat from any animal that tests positive for the disease. If you have deer or elk commercially processed, request that your animal is processed individually without meat from other animals being added from your animal. End quote. Currently, there is no strong evidence that CWD can be transmitted to humans, but prions are serious threats to health and should be treated as such. Populations could suffer from the disease. However, the population level effects of the disease remain to be seen and will hopefully be kept at bay by proper precautions. The precautions, although possibly inconvenient, are well worth it to protect wildlife and promote hunting for future generations.
Anyway.
Let's get political.
Oh my God. Okay.
One, two.
Okay.
All right. How do you feel about the way Oregon does spike bull hunting?
I do not like it.
What do you not like about it?
Okay. Well, now I can pull this up here. So.
Are you about to hit me with a spreadsheet?
Yeah. No. Well, I have those, but we don't have to get into that.
I've never made a spreadsheet.
You haven't?
No. Or a PowerPoint.
Do you need me to teach you how to use Excel?
No.
Okay.
Look at how I'm crushing it right now without having ever done this. And if I make one, then I can't make fun of people that make them.
Oh, well, my boss, when I have like my budget meetings and things along those lines, I've got like full spreadsheets mm-hmm. and, you know, quotas good. And percentages and all of the good stuff.
Well, if I need one.
I didn't go to business school, okay? But I figured it out.
If I need one produced, I'll just like send you the details.
Okay, let me know because I can do that.
All right.
But here, for example, so with the spike hunting, I understand that it provides a hunting opportunity, but I A, don't think it's a good one. B, I don't like that it's taking out an entire age class of bulls every single year. Specifically from units like Mount Emily, Walla Walla, and Wenaha. So if you look at this with me real quick, you can see there's the Mount Emily unit, number 2, which is our rifle bull hunt. There's 58 tags. There's almost 7,000 applicants.
Which means that you're going to have to apply for that for about 25 years in order to draw. Or
yes.
to put that more accurately, you would have had to have started 25 years ago to draw it. Now, if you start now,
it'll be 30.
Maybe.
If you're lucky.
You might not ever run into it.
Yeah, that the point creep thing is real and it is frustrating. And I've also pitched to ODF&W about that as far as like generating different hunts, maybe muzzleloader hunts in these units where, again, it would be beneficial if they were to cut the spike tags because then they could do these muzzleloader hunts and that would remove some of the point creep because some of the applicants would switch over.
You'd have so many wounded bulls.
Yeah, but you get a lot of wounded bulls with archery too.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
Like
so
a lot.
Let me ask you this. Because okay. I talk with a bunch of guides about this year in particular.
We do not allow for expandable broadheads for our elk hunts.
Okay.
If that's what you were getting
at. That's not what I was getting at, but thank you for that.
We do not. That is in our contracts. And I put that in there because I saw one season of that and I'm like, never again.
Yeah.
Never again.
No, it's such garbage. It's insane that people think that what works on 130-pound whitetail will work on an 800-pound elk.
Yeah, and they're like, well, it's a big hole. And I'm like, that's not the point of any of this.
Yeah.
Like, that's, anyway.
Anyways, that's enough of that. Expandable's trash. Unless you're shooting a whitetail, at which point.
It's great.
Whatever.
For that.
Yeah, I think that you could kill them with a field point and, like, stiff veins on your arrows. They don't, they're like a sheep. They don't have a big will to live. No. What percentage of bulls shot with archery equipment do you think are recovered versus not recovered?
Me personally, or what I've read?
I think just in total.
I believe strongly that it's got to be under 30%, well under 30%. Because I mean, I've witnessed, even when you put an elk in front of someone, it happened this year. We had elk at 30 yards and stopped him broadside, and he was at full draw and he shot it square in the ass. I've never seen a more perfect shot right there when the full, and he was like, where did I hit it? And I'm like, what do you know? We're, and then he's like, well, are we going to track it? And I'm like, well, we're going to track it for a minute to find your arrow if we can, but that thing's not going to die. It's actually just going to be really annoyed for like 2 days. But I mean, it's got to be well under 30% with the animals that are actually hit with an arrow.
You think around 1 in 3 are recovered?
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, 1 in 3 that are fatally killed are recovered, I would say, because there's a lot of people that I know that'll hit something and they're like, oh, it wasn't a good hit. They don't find their arrow, but they're like, you know, they probably pitched it out somewhere, or it went in quote unquote no man's land, or all of these other places.
Oh my God, yeah.
that aren't a thing. You can open any anatomy text and just see that. But no, I think it's under 30%, which is really frustrating. And we also kill bulls. I mean, the bull that I shot this year had scar tissue from maybe a bow.
Yeah.
Maybe he was fighting with another bull, but he had it all over his diaphragm, which seemed like a really weird place considering he had next to no notable scarring like on his hide, which was weird. So I don't know how else he would have gotten that unless there was like some tiny little arrow hole and it went in there, because I feel like if it was a bull that, you know, hooked him, it would have hit a bunch of other stuff and it would have really screwed him up.
Yeah. So I'm actually really close to you on this. I think around 1 in 3, if I'm being like really generous and optimistic, 1 in 2, but easily 50 to 70% of bull elk that are hit with arrows are not recovered, but
yeah,
would be my honest assessment of it. And that's having done this for over 30 years and talking with hunters and my own experience as a guide, It's bad. It's bad. And that's why I'm out there all the time talking about equipment. I'm not making money off that. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm doing that because I want to stop this pain. I want to stop people from wounding so many elk. It's
crazy.
I'm
tired of finding deadheads. It's not great. Like, one of the great things about shooting a gun is, even if, and I know you know this, and it's not, it's like the worst part about guiding, but it's just something you have to deal with. Even if you shoot him in the leg, it slows him down a lot and you get to hit him again. More than likely, you can hit him again pretty quickly. They're not going to be out of range. And even if they're a little further, you just hold a little higher or you make an adjustment on your, you know, turret, something. But that bullet does so much damage, especially if you hit him like, you know, even in the gut, they just stop moving.
Guns are like, more lethal. That's the bottom line. So, you know, one of the reason that I bow hunted in Oregon, and I was so reluctant to even talk about this, but I think it's important, so we're doing it. The reason that I bow hunted in Oregon was because that was what gave me an opportunity to hunt every year.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that I loved bow hunting. It was that I loved hunting, and that was the only tag that I could get every year.
And getting close is fun.
You can get close with a gun. There's no rule.
You could get very close with a gun. I got one of my hunters like last year to 35 yards and she was like, what? And I'm like, shoot it in the back of the head. And she's like, I don't know. And I'm like, we're within archery range. You can shoot it in the back. And she did. And she got her cow. But yeah, no, you can get very close with a gun.
There's no rule. And I hear that from so many people who are like, well, I like to get close. Okay, get close with a gun. It's mm-hmm. amazing. Hunting close range with a rifle is amazing.
Yeah.
That bear I shot in North Carolina last week was at like 12 feet.
Yeah.
It was all the way close. My heart rate hit 147 beats per minute while I was sitting still, mm-hmm. right? It's amazing. And like getting excited isn't the only reason to do it, but anyways, get close with the gun, have fun. But for me, I love the most lethal option available. The most lethal option available that is legal for me to use, that's what I want to use. And that's going to be a gun most of the time. Okay, but muzzleloaders, especially the way muzzleloader laws are written in Oregon, it's going to be much the same problem. We're going to wound a grip of bulls. It's going to be a disaster if we do that.
No, I agree. You know, and people can argue like, well, people are shooting stuff all the time with rifles and wounding them. Yeah. And that's with any weapon. Yeah. That's just any weapon. But at least a rifle, you know, especially if you're out there shooting a caliber that is of the right size, you should be shooting for an elk. Not a 6.5 Creedmoor.
Atta girl.
You will slow him down enough and more than likely get another shot, yeah, even if you hit him in like not the best spot.
Yeah.
Anyway, so these spike tags, specifically for our trophy units, very frustrating for me. I am a thorn in the side of the local biologists and commission, whoever. I don't think it's fair or right that someone would wait 25 to 35 or more years of their life to draw a tag for one of these trophy units like Emily and have to compete with spike hunters.
How many spike hunters are those 58 branch bull hunters going up against?
Okay, so the bull elk season for this year, or this could have been last year's, but it runs November 1st through November 19th. And in that time frame, there are two spike hunts that are spike-only hunts. The first is November 1st through the 5th. There's a little gap, and then it's the 11th through the 19th. And between those dates, there are almost 1,000 spike hunters to the 58 branch bull hunters. So 58 people have waited a quarter of their life or more to draw this tag, and they are shoulder to shoulder with 1,000 spike hunters. And that's insane. That doesn't make any sense to me. I'm like, why one are we taking out an entire age group of 2, 2.5 year old bulls out of a trophy unit that's supposed to be managed for bulls, bigger branch bulls, obviously, but they have to be young at some point. But it's like that across all of the units. It's Walla Walla, same thing. There's 26 tags with
Snake River, Imnaha.
Yeah, all of them. Yeah. All of them are like that. But at least, you know, these are quote-unquote controlled tags, but it really doesn't matter because most people, even if they don't draw them their first choice, they'll draw it their second because there's not, you know, the ratio here. There's not enough first-choice applicants to draw that. But still, like, why is that even a thing at all?
Well, I think that if you take Colorado, for example, they got rid of spike hunting a long time ago, and they made a brow point restriction, brow tine restriction. So I think you have to have like a brow tine on each side that's 5 inches long or something close to that. Montana has something similar. What happened in both of those states and the areas where they implemented that, instead of killing the bulls at a year and a half when they're spikes, they were all dying at 2.5 years old. And what happened on a larger scale is it actually took away from their top end. So the bulls weren't getting older. So they had fewer big bulls and then a lot more like middle class bulls. Hmm. And if you look at Colorado, like it's a raghorn factory. And they just don't produce that many big bulls. And most of Montana is very much the same way. So I think that there is an advantage to spike harvest, but there's not a good reason to have it at the same time.
Or this scale.
As
the scale is
hunt.
Shocking.
And, you know, most of these units, we're killing as many spikes as we are cows, if not more. And, you know, we do need to reduce the number of males in a herd. Like, that just has to happen because we're having the same number of bull calves as we are cow calves. And a bull can breed 25 cows, right? So we don't need to have as many bulls as we do cows. You know, a really healthy ratio would be somewhere between like, you know, one in 10 or one in 15. Like that would be great for these trophy units. nature is going to do a lot of that for us, right? So as those cows come into estrus, if they have a bull calf at their side, they're going to get rid of that calf, and he's going to go out and get killed by predators who are now not going to mess with the rest of the herd. Like, there is a rhyme and a reason for all this ecologically. But when we're talking about the hunting opportunity, which is a big part of what the state is required to manage for, we need to consider the hunter experience. And I think that reducing the number of spikes that are harvested would help a lot. And I think that pushing those hunters to a different season would be perfectly fine. Like, make it later. Let the guys and gals who have dutifully applied for 25 years, paid that money year after year after year after year, mm-hmm. and gotten nothing in return, and they finally draw that tag, like, let them have that wilderness experience and be out there with fewer individuals and elk that are not pressured as much. I'm completely on board with you on that.
Yeah. And, you know, if they want to have those spike tags for their revenue, that's fine. But you don't need that many in these units. Like, we have the second season general spike tag that is in quite a few different units. They've got those different hunts for rosies on the coast. And that's all fine and dandy. But for this, like, application spike hunts seems just, I don't know. Yeah. I don't like what it's doing to these units.
We have high spike harvest in units where the bull to cow ratio is not meeting the management objective for that unit.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
So if we don't have enough bulls that are surviving hunting season to reach the management objective, you need to reduce the number of bulls being harvested by hunters. Like, mm-hmm. that's one of the only levers you can pull there. And you should probably be doing it with the spike harvest.
Exactly. Like, yes, they are young and dumb. Most teenage boys are. That's just kind of the nature of things. So they are
all age.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we don't get smarter, really.
Yeah. But, you know, and I don't allow for spike hunts on the ranch at all. If someone with one of our rifle bull or archery bull tags wants to shoot a spike, so be it. They paid for a branch bull, though, but you can shoot a spike if you are so inclined.
They taste delicious.
Yes, they do. Absolutely. But so does a 2-year-old cow. And I get calls all the time and they're like, well, I don't want to shoot the girls. And I'm like, okay, are you going to put that spike on your wall? And the answer is always no. And I'm like, okay, well, we have damage problems with cows. We don't have damage problems with the 20 spikes that I see on the entire ranch. So we're going to leave them alone. For these, you know, that's private land stuff, so it is what it is. But for these units specifically, and this is my biggest complaint, is our big three and how there's just a slaughter of spikes.
Yeah. How would you fix the preference point system in Oregon?
How would I do it?
Yeah.
And
I'll tell you folks why this matters. Because Miss Hannah Mabbitt is being considered as an option for the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission, representing her river basin, which would be a great thing. I think that you would be a tremendous, tremendous asset to the commission. We need people like you on it. You come to it with a lot of passion, with a lot of knowledge. You actually do the thing. You would be a huge asset there. But you're going to be making decisions on that commission that will affect every hunter that hunts in the state of Oregon. So the preference point system, a lot of people feel like it's broken, myself included.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on it?
No, I absolutely do. But, you know, the thing is while I have my own opinions on it, I would want to host a community forum to hear other people's ideas on what they would consider, because I don't think that my idea of it, which would be to essentially cut certain hunts, add others, to force people to utilize their points in other ways, to reduce the point creep, that may just be a band-aid. It may not fix the entire thing. I know Oregon has a ton of general seasons with both deer and elk that could be controlled. And
on the west side.
On the west side. And we do, you know, we have the second season spike and some of these other things that, you know, don't require any points. And those can be altered as well. But I would want to hear from the people to see who, you know, but that's kind of, if you were in that position of power, isn't that kind of your right to represent the people around you to, like, you know, give them a voice at that level? So I feel like that would be...
It's your duty, but, you know, we're just talking about
it. Right, but duty, yeah, of course. But yeah, I would, I mean, me personally, I would alter how the tags are structured now as far as the applications. Probably add a few hunts here and there, remove some in other places, and just hope that that can change that spread. But I mean, that's one thing that I like about Idaho is that their applications are completely random every year. But it's also something that really frustrates me about Idaho. And I think that if you were to get rid of the point system right now in Oregon, there would be a riot. Because, I mean, so many of us, I know right now I've got a slew of points. I'm sure you do. And I know a ton of other people that do as well. And there's quite a few friends of mine that are like 18 or 19 points. Like they're really close to getting their hypothetical branch, big branch bull tag. And they would freak out. But, you know, that.
What about max points?
I think max points is, it would be good. I think that if you get to max points that you would need to use them within like 2 or 3 years and then it resets. So then people aren't just sitting there with max points.
Well, if you, let's say 10, just arbitrary number, 10 is max points for any hunt in the state. You can keep applying for it at 10, but like it is, you're not going to get 11 points. You know, you're going to be in it against everybody else who has 10. Another thing that drives me crazy, and I think we probably need a minimum points for these, are sheep and goat. Like, I don't know that people need to be drawing those tags their first time ever applying for them. That shouldn't be their first hunt.
Oh, no, absolutely not. That is driving me crazy. I mean...
So if you had like a minimum of 5, like you have to apply for this tag for 5 years before you even have a chance of drawing it.
Doesn't Colorado do that?
I don't know.
I forgot what... There is a state that does that. I think it might be Colorado. I think you have to put in for a few years before you can even be like considered.
But no 12-year-old should go sheep hunting.
No.
Not in Oregon.
Unless it's a... Like last hunt kind
yeah,
of a thing.
Yeah.
But no, I agree. And it drives me crazy. There's actually one of my client's kids and I took him out on his first elk hunt last year and it was incredible. He was shaking like a leaf after he shot his elk and it was just the best thing ever. Perfect shot too. But I helped them with their tag application stuff later that evening. I just wrote down a bunch of stuff on a list, like apply for this, 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 and this. Mostly youth tags, but mm-hmm. also I threw in goat and sheep because whatever. He drew a sheep tag, so yeah. My bad for that. But I was just, I of course didn't think he would get it. It was a ewe tag, but still I was like.
Which, why do we even okay. have those?
Well. I don't know. Why haven't we put Oddad or Ibex in Snake River?
Amen. Like, that's what I'm talking that? About.
I mean, I want to get one of those things pretty bad, but I don't have time to...
Have you been reading my diary? That's exactly what I want to do.
I have not, but I would really think that they would do so well. They would do so well.
They would crush.
And it would be so much fun, too.
And it would be an opportunity, and they would utilize the landscape. They would reduce fire hazard, and the 17... colored double ear tag snivel nose bighorns that are left in there, like they can make it or not, but they're just government sponsored farm animals at this point.
They are. They're the big money ones. They're the big, they're what it's a status symbol. I mean, my brother and he drew his sheep tag this year over in the Minum area, and it was an incredible experience. It was a super fun hunt, but there's like none in there. And it seems like
how many lion tracks did you see?
Oh, there were lion and bear tracks everywhere. I was like not super jacked that I didn't have my rifle and I wasn't going to take a rifle. I had my sidearm, but I was just like, oh my God. Okay.
What kind of pistol do you carry?
I have a 10 millimeter, but I've got a 9 and a 38 as well, but I usually have my 10.
Not a girl.
And I have a 40. I like my 40 a lot because I can like drop it in the mud and it still works. It's great.
Your 10 doesn't do that?
No.
Who made it?
Ruger.
Oh.
Yeah. It's fine. It's fine. I mean, I'm sure it would, but I've shot my 40 after I dropped in the mud and it was great. And I'm like, cool.
Who made your 40?
I think it's also a Ruger actually, but
I have
anyway.
I have a Ruger that I used to compete with a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I called that SR9. They don't make it anymore. And it was a great gun. It was a great gun. But yeah.
Yeah. I got this for like $500. It was great. I was like, paperwork done, whatever. But I just got a nice tip once and was like, okay, well, new gun time. But anyway, yeah, so
it's pretty great when you get a tip, isn't it?
It's so nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely tip your guides, take care of them because they deserve it and they work really hard and you know,
it's a lot of hours and guides are trying to make their year's worth of money in not the whole year.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that by working all year and only getting paid for part of it. And, yeah, it's a nice thing to tip your guides. 10 out of 10 would recommend
to do that. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. Sheep and goats. I've my like dream hunt or one of them, I guess, is a goat hunt. I love them. I love to go like scout them in the summer and just look at them even when I'm not drawing the tag and I'm not scouting for anyone. I'm just going to look at them cause I think they're cool. And usually I can find bears and stuff, you know, in early August as well or in the spring. But, I think they're a much cooler animal than a sheep personally, because you can see sheep next to the highway and you can't see goats next to the highway, exception being Perry. Don't come at me with that. I don't know why they're there. They're just there now. But they're mostly like way out in the middle of nowhere and you got to really work hard to get close to them.
And they're an awesome animal that only exists in America.
Yeah. And they're really tough.
They're our goat,
mm-hmm.
you know? So many of our animals do exist elsewhere, but not the mountain goat. That one's just ours.
Yeah. And they're so beautiful too. Like just this white animal. It's, I mean, we had one in Pilot Rock like a year or two ago. That was weird.
And they spend their winters up high.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if people like ever think about that or spend enough time thinking about it. It's all fine and dandy to see them up in a craggy, you know, just absolute vertical piece of rock someplace in the summertime.
Where it looks like someone just put it there. Like, I don't know how you got there. I don't know how you're getting away from that. I would die where you're at, but they're just there.
For sure. And then they spend their winter up there.
Mm-hmm.
When there's 20 feet of snow and they're going to the place that gets hit by wind so hard that the snow and ice can't stick to it, and they're scraping lichen off the rocks with their little goat teeth. Like, how do they do it? I'd be in an alfalfa pivot laying down.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just don't understand how they do it.
No, they're so tough. And that's what I'm saying. Like, they're incredible animals. And they don't get, I don't think they get the recognition they deserve because they're not a sheep.
Thank God.
But too, sheep don't do that.
No.
I mean, some might, sure, like some stones or fannins and whatever, but even them, they drop down lower and they're on roadways and things along those lines. But no, those goats stay up in that like year round and it's wild. And they don't need all the government assistance.
No.
And the fundraising.
They get
and
no
all
love.
The things. They don't get,
they get
like,
the opposite of love.
And
they get the National Park Service gunning them down out of helicopters whenever they feel like they're too many of them.
Which is so sad.
Drives me crazy.
That's so sad. But yeah, I'm going to keep putting in
garbage
for a goat tag year after year trying to get one. But one of these days I'll save up enough and maybe just go up to Alaska and get one there. But that just...
That's what I did.
I know. And that would... It sounds great and I really want to do it. But... I also want to get one in Oregon.
It's also $10,000.
Yeah. No, I like the cheapest one I saw was like $8,800 and it was more of like a semi-guided thing. And I'm like, oh my God, like that's like more than 4 mortgage payments. I'm like, I can't just do that.
Yeah.
I know. So
kidneys are worth like $30,000, I think.
Kidneys are worth a lot. You can sell your eggs. You can sell all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't really want to go down the route of selling body parts to pay for stuff, because I think it's, I don't know if it's worth it at that point.
I've thought about it. If 3D printing comes along a little bit farther, and then I'll be like, okay, in 5 years, they'll be able to 3D print me a new kidney so I can sell one right now. And then, you know, spend a month in Tanzania. Might be worth a gamble. I don't know.
$200. I think I saw something like, there's six figures if you get a kidney. I can sell one, but anytime.
That's nice.
Yeah, you can. Well, no, you can't sell bone marrow. You can donate it, which I actually recently found out I can't do.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry to hear that.
Oh, it's all right. I mean,
well,
I'm not.
I'm sure it was a circumstance under which you wanted to.
Yeah, it was, because I did like that Be the Match thing and whatever, and I wanted to help someone out, but I have a rare anemic condition, and it will not allow me to do that because I have issues regenerating bone marrow.
Maybe you got bit by a tick.
Don't do that. No. I mean, I have before. Actually, the last time I did, and I have no shame in saying this, two, maybe three summers ago, I was spending an ungodly amount of time in a huckleberry patch. And I got home and I was cleaning the berries out, jumped in the shower. Before you get in the shower, you know, you're like getting undressed and whatever. And I looked in the mirror and I'm like, I didn't have a mole there before. And then the doom set in that there was a tick embedded in my left butt cheek. Because of course I was wearing like shorts, you know, loose fitting clothes. I had a full meltdown, and I ended up calling one of my parents to come over and help me get it, because I was like, I can't even touch it. I don't know what I'm going to do. And yeah. My mom was like, you've literally like been on wilderness trips and like not had cell service for 7 days, and you've dealt with much worse than this. Why is this your breaking point? And I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah,
it is. Everyone has one, and mine is that, and excessive amounts of mud. Like getting up in like tires and having, just getting it on everything. Like once you get, like, you know what the mud's like down there.
You would have hated the Marine Corps.
I wouldn't have joined, you know? They would be like, okay, so you're going to like see some things and it's going to be really awful. I'm going to be like, okay, that's, I can deal with that. And they'd say mud and I'm done. Mm-hmm. I'm out.
Yeah.
No, mud is
kryptonite.
Not my friend.
Yeah.
Blood, totally fine with it. I'll get completely covered in it, and that's fine, but not the blood.
I don't like gut shot smell, like, at all. Like, really, really don't like it. And
how do you guide then? Because that's a thing.
Sure is.
They're like, center mass, right there. And I'm like, okay.
Let me tell you, I have a little jar of Vicks.
Oh.
Vicks Vapor Rub.
Okay.
It sits on the bench next to all my knives. And if it's gutty, I'm taking a big old goober of that and putting it up each nostril, and I can take on the world.
So the worst smell that I've encountered in an elk so far, and I'm saying so far because it might get worse. I don't know.
It's going to get worse.
It's going to get worse before it gets better. There was a cow that one of my hunters shot a year ago. And we were walking up to it, and I'm like, something smells off here. As we were walking up, and he hadn't shot it in the gut, and I'm, you know, I like ask him, I'm like, you didn't, it looked like you'd shot this in the heart. And he's like, I was aiming for that. And I'm like, okay, cool. So we get up to it, and I'm starting to field dress it and whatnot, and there's no blood in the lower cavity. So I'm like, okay, well, you didn't shoot it in the guts. And as soon as I cut that diaphragm, I was, you know how like the pressure release, mm-hmm. so it blows that air. I was like, that's the first time, because I have a really strong, real strong gag reflex. And I was like, huh? I'm like, what? I was like, what is happening right now? And he was like, are you okay? And you know when your mouth gets hot and you start like drooling? I was like, I don't know what's going on, but this isn't good. And he's like, do you need a minute? And I'm like, no, I'm going to just get this over with. I cut the diaphragm out and I reach up, and I just feel slime as I'm like reaching in, and I was like, I can't, I don't know what's going on, but I just need to get it over with. and I pull everything out, and one of the lungs had been completely deflated and was gangrenous, like green, rancid goo, slime coming off of it. I don't know how this thing was alive. I don't know how she was doing so well. She wasn't acting messed up at all. Later when we were skinning it out, we found a hole, and I want to assume either she was shot or a mountain lion had got her on her chest.
Mm.
There was a big hole and it went into the lung and it was putrid. Like, that's the best word to describe the situation. Yeah. Putrid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the worst smell I've ever smelled. And it was festered. We had to cut the majority of the meat was fine, but we couldn't salvage her brisket. And that was about it. The brisket was messed up, but like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
We found a bull at like, I don't know, 8 a.m. that had been shot at literally the last minute of shooting light
the day before.
And that's about max for actually saving an elk.
You want to get on them like pretty quick unless it's super, super, super cold. And even then,
like,
there's so much heat in the neck and hips of those things.
And if they have a belly full of food, like, that just gets hotter. I mean, go put a bunch of grass trimmings in a bag and leave it out and see what happens. Like, that stuff.
That's how hay catches on fire.
Ready to catch
on
fire.
Wet, like, wet hay, yeah.
Yeah. So if they've been eating, you know, they're just going to cook from the inside out all night long. Anyways, if you're seeing dudes on TV talking about finding stuff 2 days later and cutting it up, they're lying.
Like, well, and the guys that are like posing them up and they're stiff, like their necks are stiff for pictures. I'm like, you can't eat that.
It's trash. So anyways, we were able to salvage all the meat from this elk, but just barely. And anyways, found it, you know, first light, got it hung up, and Kevin Harlander and I were the ones that were skinning and gutting it. Skinning it, no big deal. But when we went to start gutting it, I couldn't do it. Kevin couldn't do it. So we would stand outside the shop and like gag and spit for a while and then wait until like the breathing had stabilized, take a deep breath, run in there, cut for as long as we could on our breath, and then run back out and throw up on the ground. And it, you know, took us 5 times longer than it should have to get this elk. But yeah, no.
We've definitely had some bad ones, but I can handle the gut smell. That is not a problem. Mm. Like, I can get right in there. Like, I don't wear gloves. That's not an issue. Like, whatever. But that putrid, like rotting, whatever. It wasn't even like flesh anymore. It was just yellow,
right.
Green.
You should wear gloves. And it's not about like an ick or anything like that, but especially with the number of wolves that we have racking diseases through these areas, you don't want any of that stuff to get in a little nick in your hands. Like, just wear gloves. They don't weigh anything.
What is the and I have a story about this, but what is the worst like thing you've gotten from like an elk or a deer, like off that point? Like, have you ever like cut your hand and it got infected or like eaten something bad or nothing?
No.
Cool. Well, guess what happened to me a couple years ago? There was an elk that one of my hunters shot. And when he shot it, I was like, ah, there's something wrong with that thing. And we get up to it and she would have died that night, I think. Like, there was almost no blood in it. She didn't even have back straps. Like, you could see through her. I have pictures of it. It was gnarly. So ODF&W was going to come out, take the animal for testing, reissue a tag. But I told him, because I've got a pretty good working relationship with our local biologist, and I'm like, I'll just get it skinned out for you so it's just easier.
Yeah.
And so I was doing that, and my hunter wanted to help, which we don't always need.
I have a trick for that I'll tell you offline.
Yeah. And I was like, you know what? I got this. You're good. Just go get a beer.
Yeah.
Watch some TV, do something. And I was leaned over, and he, one of the lymph nodes were all black on this thing, I should say, like, for the record, every single one, like necks, hip, everything. They were all black.
Yikes.
And I was getting the last of the skin or the hide off of the neck, and he stuck a knife in one of the lymph nodes, and he's like, what is this? And I'm like, well, it's a lymph node. It's like your tonsils. Like, we've all got them. And instead of just taking his knife out, he kind of like slashed away, and it sprayed that stuff in my face. And, you know, me just almost being done with the job, I was like, I'll just rinse my face off later, whatever. I ended up almost losing my eye.
No kidding.
Yeah. So that stuff, like, it got in my left eye, all over my face, and it was like, oh my God, okay. And at that point, I was like, can you please just go somewhere, please, for a second. Let me finish this up, and then we'll figure out what we're going to do here. I got home that night, and I was actually talking with an OSP officer about a poaching incident. He's like, oh, so you were out hunting today. How did that go? And I kind of told him what happened. He's like, you know, like an officer over on the coast lost his eye from something like that. And I was like, really? You don't say? And he's like, yeah, maybe you should go get that looked at. And I like hang up the phone. I don't really think anything about it. And my face was pretty hot, but I just assumed it was windburn. And I went into the bathroom and like, you could almost take a line down my face and the left half of it was bright red.
Wow.
And my eye was hot. And it's like within like an hour of that, it progressed to the point where I could barely see out of my left eye. So I went to the ER and they stuck a lens in there, which was the weirdest feeling ever. Like it's the size of your eye. They like shove it under your eyelids. And they rinsed, I think, 2 bags of saline through it. And then I got put on a really high dose of antibiotics. But I forgot exactly what it was, but there was some crazy disease. And she's like, well, if you would have waited overnight to come in here, you probably wouldn't be able to see.
No kidding.
Out of that eye. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Everything's fine now, but that was pretty terrifying, not going to lie.
Wow. I'm glad that wasn't worse.
Yeah, definitely could have been. But that's, you know, it's just one of those stupid things you wouldn't expect to happen, but it just happened. Here's the, there's the lens in the eye.
It doesn't even look like you.
No, I was also like 30 pounds heavier, but miserable in this picture. Yeah, because there was just that's the like nasty coming out.
Yuck.
Oh, it was great.
Eyelashes are on point, though.
Thank you. Yes, that's something that the hunters talk about all the time. And some of my guides make fun of me for it, too. But I think that you can... And this is kind of like going way back to something we were talking about earlier, but you can do both. You can like hold your own and guide and hunt and do whatever you want to do and get disgusting, but you can also do other things in your off time.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know. I feel sometimes like I have like split lives, not split personalities, but split lives in that like, when I'm not at work, like I like to go to the gym and like take good care of myself and go cooking and do all of these like more feminine things, like the modeling and whatnot. But then I'm at work and it's like not wearing makeup, haven't washed my hair in a week and a half, fingernails are all broken off. Like you can do both things, but I'm always going to have eyelashes because, yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's just one thing that makes me feel I don't know, more, not necessarily more feminine at work, but like I know that I'm working in a very male dominated profession, and there's nothing wrong with that because it's a lot of hard work and it's very physically demanding, and it's not something I think that, you know, all women and even some men are meant to do and can do, especially without help. But I don't know. It's just how I want to look. I want to look like a female.
Yeah.
No matter if I'm like in the field or like at home. Like I have no problem with that.
Good.
Yeah.
I think Rachel Attila talked about the same thing. She's a Canadian sheep guide, and yeah, she likes to look like a woman, and I think that that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that anymore there's all of these like, and I'm not getting political right now, but there's like the genderings and the this and the that. And I'm like, don't put me in a little box. I'm not trying to not fit in a box, but like, don't assume that because I can, you know, bust my ass working, you know, driving side by sides, pickups, doing all of this stuff at work that like I can't turn around and like dress nice and go to nice dinners and do these other things. Like you can do both things. You don't have to do one or the other. And that is very hard for some people to wrap their mind around.
And I think that if people go to your Instagram, which I encourage them to do, that's what they're going to see, right? And it can feel like there's a dichotomy that you're looking at two different people. But what people are going to realize, especially after listening to you talk, is that, no, this is one person. This is the same person.
And I'm not an Insta huntress. I'm not posting pictures in like skimpy camo. Like that's not my thing at all. I think that's a big cringe.
If you were, you wouldn't be on this show.
Right.
Right. So it's important to me to host people like you who are positive role models, because there's a lot of negative role models out there. You know, I just read about an AI model that is making $11,000 a month.
An AI? So it doesn't even...
It's not a human, right?
Where's that money going?
So the money is going to the engineers that are running this AI program. She has a name. She wears the clothes that these companies, you know...
Actually, I think I know who you're talking about. She does like high fashion stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Spanish.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep.
But we're increasingly coming to a point where it's going to be hard to know what's real and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that somebody could be influenced to wear something by what a computer program is presenting, right? This isn't even a human. This is just what a computer thinks is the ideal of what a human should be. And that's influencing how people should act for themselves. Like, that's crazy. What I want people to think about are people like you. And like, okay, here's this person. This is what they're all about. And, you know, they can look at what you're posting. They can listen to the show and hear about what you're talking about and see that you have your own opinions that come from experience and all these things. Like, you are what people should be modeling themselves after, right? And that's where the word comes from. It's not the other way around. It's not that people should be trying to aspire to an ideal that is so difficult to achieve that it's easier to do with a computer simulation than it is in real life. So, right. Yeah, if you're the skimpy camo Insta huntress, I wouldn't be talking to you on the show. I wouldn't give you the platform to tell your stories.
Right. And I very much appreciate that. But yeah, that is like the biggest, like when people start talking about these things and whatnot, and they're like, well, why aren't you sponsored? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? And I'm like, well, I don't advertise myself and I don't put myself out there in a way to where companies are like, oh, let's, you know, give her a bow so she can shoot in her backyard in jorts. Like, I just don't, that's not my thing. I don't reach out to companies. I don't do any of that, you know. And I think it's great when people do, like, make your money, do your thing, whatever. But I do not like when I'm being compared to people like that. It is really frustrating, and I feel like it's kind of a slap in the face when people are like, well, I know XYZ, and she shoots this, and she does that. And I'm like, cool. She's also being paid to go on guided hunts and, like, do all of these things, and that's fine for her. That's great. But, like, she also is advertising herself in a completely different way and probably isn't as educated on a lot of these things. Like, she has to have someone holding her hand. Like, she's not going to do this by herself. Like, she has a boyfriend or a dad or somebody that's kind of guiding her through hunting, but she found a niche in a very male dominated you know, hobby, line of work, whatever it is for that person, but where she's getting a lot of popularity, and that's great, but it's also not real. You know, it's just someone taking pictures in a swimsuit, just like, I don't know, you could do that at like NASCAR or like sporting events, all of these things. Like, they're in great shape. That's fantastic for them. But that's just like the picture they want you to see.
Well, there are companies out there that value authenticity. And I think that just because somebody's sponsored doesn't mean that they're disingenuous, or, you know, you can have people like yourself who are very authentic and are the real deal who are sponsored. And
oh no, there definitely are. I'm not taking away from that. I'm just speaking solely on the
This other thing off to the side. And if a company wants to do that, then you should really think about whether you want to give them your money or not.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, I didn't do a great job of explaining that, but that's what I'm saying. It's like, it's an image thing. So like, if this company is giving, you know, equipment and whatnot to this kind of individual, I don't want to spend my money there.
Yeah.
There are brands like, I know Stone Glacier is a great one. Sitka does a pretty good job. I think Montana Knife Company, they do a great job. There's a few others that...
Sitka doesn't have a lot of ugly chicks working for them.
No, they don't. But most of them are actually doing stuff from the look of it, at least from what I've seen.
Yeah.
But,
they've got some great ones.
Yeah.
But there is that reality too.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. And then there's also, you know, the sponsored people that are sponsored with other things that wear the Sitka, and then there's that. Yeah. But... No, I'm just meaning explicitly the people that are doing it for all the wrong reasons. They just want the attention.
Yep.
And that drives me nuts. And if I'm ever compared to people like that, it's like, okay, just because I'm a woman doing this doesn't mean like that is the comparison, you know? It's apples and oranges.
Better to
for
be the
sure.
contrast.
Yep. Yeah, I'm like, I'm good. Thank you for whatever that was supposed to be, if that was supposed to be nice, but no.
Let me shift gears here a little bit. What type of hunts do Hunt Oregon offer?
So we right now are primarily big game, elk, deer. We do some spring bear if a tag is drawn, you know, that.
Whitetail, mule deer only?
Both. Yeah. So we do, we have the West Blues whitetail hunts. Of course, if you were to draw a mule deer tag, you could shoot a whitetail out there, but I don't know why you'd want to, because our mule deer are great. But we have both management and trophy class mule deer hunts that we run. We do archery bull hunts, rifle bull hunts, rifle and archery cow hunts, and some spring bear, spring turkey. And we also have 4 upland game bird preserves, as well as a lot of native birds. And so that's kind of a thing that it isn't talked about as much, but our bird population is amazing. And we can offer a lot of great opportunities for people to bring their own dogs. We have guides that have dogs. I do that myself as well. I have an English setter. He's great. Just whatever you can think of in Oregon other than sheep and goats. Technically, we have antelope as well. It's just really hard to get the tag. But
I get people all the time asking if I guide lions. I don't. Do you?
See, that's so kind of. It's like a... There's an asterisk there. Okay. So I'll take people out. We refer to them more as predator hunts. And so we'll go do call sets and things along those lines. We usually call in, you know, badgers, coyotes. If we're up in the timber, we'll get the coyotes, of course, still. But I've called in lions before, but it's really hard to sell a lion hunt because unless we have snow and we can try to walk one down or track one, it's difficult.
Yeah. It's the hardest hunt in the U.S.
It's difficult, yeah.
Oregon mountain lion.
Just the fact that my buddy and I called some in when we were like 20 years old is still shocking to me to this day.
Yeah.
Like we're like, we were crazy and we still figured that out. Like we didn't have any idea what we were doing and somehow we were able to get cats to come in. But
I'm going to go try on Wednesday. It's probably not going to work, but not going to kill them from the couch.
No. No, and power to you. Are you going to be down?
No, I'll be up north.
Gotcha. Because we've got like one or two that are going between public and private. And as soon as I get some fresh snow, I'm going to be down there. But right now I'm like, the one has such a large range. And I know it's the same cat because it's collared and the collar's dead. But we've seen him at the far south end of the timber property, and we've seen him at the far north. And the far north is when he ran at that kid.
Yeah.
And so it's like such a big spread. I'm like, I want to see where these tracks are. Otherwise, I'm just wasting a bunch of time.
Yep.
So I'll be right there with you in spirit, but I'm going to wait a little longer.
Yeah. No, I'll try and walk them out in the snow. I love doing that. But also, like, the days are running out of this year. I killed one lion this spring. I'd love to punch my second lion tag. I think that'd be awesome. And it makes such a meaningful impact for deer and so many other species if you can remove just one lion. So two would be incredible. And, you know, as soon as January 1st hits, I'll be buying two more tags, and I'll try all year next year too. I'll never quit. Okay, if somebody wants to book a hunt with you, how do they do it?
So you can reach us. We have a website, huntoregonllc.com. We also have an Instagram page and a Facebook, and I manage both of those accounts. So if you were to shoot us a message on there, I can get back to you pretty quickly. My email is huntoregonllc@gmail.com. And I'd prefer those methods first. And then if you're serious about a hunt inquiry, I'll give you my work cell number. But yeah, we'll get
Ask your initial questions there.
Yep.
And figure out if there's availability and stuff like that. Anything else you want to talk about?
You know, go shoot more bears.
Yeah.
Because they're pretty cool. And the meat's not gross. People say the meat's gross. It's not gross. You can do stuff with it.
Sure.
Sausage is amazing.
Yeah.
Pepperoni, whatever. I've got a freezer full of bear pepperoni. It's great.
Fat's great.
Fat's great. Fat is great.
Hides
so
are cool.
Great.
Skulls are cool.
Oh, I've got skulls all over the place. My roommate thinks I'm a crazy person. But yeah, the bear skulls are great. And go kill more lions. Just try it. Like, if you put as much effort into deer hunting as you do a lion or a bear, you're going to find one of them. Just try it instead of complaining about it. You know, the predator numbers being so high, which they are, just go do something, because there's a lot of opportunity and it's cheap.
Yeah.
It's really
all year
cheap.
Long. Mm-hmm. Don't talk about it. Be about it.
Yeah.
All right.
Do the thing.
Thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
Bye, everybody. Thank you all very much for listening. I'm going to keep bringing you these stories from normal people just like you who have done extraordinary things. Everyone is an expert at something, and they have interesting perspectives on life and work and the environment and all of the things that we care about. I'm going to keep bringing that to you. And I want to thank you so much for making this show possible. I also want to thank Emily Bratcher for producing this show. She does a great job editing. Really appreciate her. I want to thank John Chatelain. He did the art for the Six Ranch podcast. And Celia, soon to be Harlander, she digitized that so that we can get it out there on the internet for you. Also want to thank Justin Hay for writing this original music and the beautiful whistling that you're listening to right now. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. Please keep listening to the show. Write me a review if you feel like it. And just keep doing your thing, and we'll all learn from this together. It's been fun, and, you know, we're just getting started.